Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, January 29th, 2014 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, and also available via podcast. I'm your guest host, Nicole Nelson, in for Barbara DeBarco Barrett. Each week on the show, we talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. During the second half hour of our show, Marie Stone will talk with author and editor Gina Frangello. But first up, Ruth Ozeki. Ruth Ozeki is a novelist, filmmaker, and Zen Buddhist priest. She is the award-winning author of three novels, including My Year of Meats and All Over Creation. Her critically acclaimed independent films, including Having the Bones, have been screened at Sundance and aired on PBS. In 2013, she was the first practicing Zen Buddhist priest to be shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize for A Tale for the Time Being. In 2014, that book was shortlisted for the National Book Critics Circle Award in Fiction. A Tale for the Time Being, published by Penguin, is now out in paperback, and I am thrilled to have the chance to talk to her about it this morning.
Hi, Nicole.
Hi there, Ruth. So this is your first time on Writers on Writing, and it's my pleasure to welcome you.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted.
And so to start off, would you introduce the book to us?
Yeah, sure. It's a story about the relationship, really, between a writer and a reader. So you could say it's a love story, I suppose, since, you know, all relationships, I think, between writers and readers ultimately are in some way or another. In this case, the writer is a young 16-year-old girl, schoolgirl, living in Tokyo, and she's writing in a diary. And she's writing in a diary, but she's writing specifically to a writer she doesn't know. She has this feeling that that there's somebody out there in the world that she can write to, and she can, you know, she can tell her stories to, and sort of cast the book out into the world, and there will be somebody out there who will pick it up and read it. She doesn't know exactly who that writer, that reader, is going to be, and as it turns out, the reader is a blocked novelist on Vancouver Island in British Columbia. The diary sort of floats across the ocean and washes up on the beach of a remote island, and it's where it's discovered by this novelist named Ruth. So it's a story about the relationship between these two women, and, you know, as it sort of unfolds.
Okay, and there, as you said, there are these two point of views that you use in the book, and the perspective of now, the first person narrator, you inhabit this young person so fully. She's a teenager, and yet you use the slang comfortably, and it's completely believable. How did you do that? Was there research or observation?
You know, I don't know where these voices come from. You know, but you know, the characters. It's not like I'm particularly trying to do it. It's almost like the character is there, and you know, and has kind of taken up residence in my head. Now came to me early on. I mean, it was really her voice that inspired the you know, the novel to begin with. And you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, obviously I know people, I talk to people. There's not one character, one person, one friend who's an inspiration for the book. But you know, I think too, I'm familiar with a lot of Japanese pop culture. You know, I read a lot, I watch a lot of movies, and somehow, you know, she just kind of was a distillation of all of this, including, I have to say, too, the distillation of some reading I'd been doing of a 13th century Zen master named Dogen Zenji. So, you know, I don't know specifically where, you know, where Now's voice, tone of voice, quality of voice comes from, but somehow, you know, it sort of comes from all of this.
Yes, and you were going to read to us from Now's point of view. Would you do that for us?
Yes, sure, certainly. So this is the voice that I started to hear in December of 2006. And so this was the voice I started to hear. Hi. My name is Now, and I'm a time being. Do you know what a time being is? Well, if you give me a moment, I will tell you. A time being is someone who lives in time, and that means you and me and every one of us who is or was or ever will be. As for me, right now, I'm sitting in a French maid cafe in Akiba Electricity Town, listening to a sad chanson that's playing sometime in your past, which is also my present, writing this and wondering about you, somewhere in my future. And if you're reading this, then maybe by now you're wondering about me too. You wonder about me. I wonder about you. Who are you, and what are you doing? Are you in a New York subway car hanging from a strap or soaking in your hot tub in Sunnyvale? Are you sunbathing on a sandy beach in Phuket or having your toenails buffed in Abu Dhabi? Are you a male or a female or somewhere in between? Is your girlfriend cooking you a yummy dinner or are you eating cold Chinese noodles from a box? Are you curled up with your back turned coldly towards your snoring wife, or are you eagerly waiting for your beautiful lover to finish his bath so you can make passionate love to him? Do you have a cat? And is she sitting on your lap? Does her forehead smell like cedar trees and fresh, sweet air? Actually, it doesn't matter very much, because by the time you read this, everything will be different, and you will be nowhere in particular, flipping idly through the pages of this book, which happens to be the diary of my last days on Earth, wondering if you should keep on reading. And if you decide not to read anymore, hey, no problem, because you're not the one I was waiting for anyway. But if you do decide to read on, then guess what? You're my kind of time being, and together we'll make magic.
Thank you so much. That was Ruth Ozeki reading from her novel, A Tale for the Time Being, published by Penguin. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. Now, regarding now, Ruth, you have this deep fondness for her, at least it seems that way, and yet you don't get hampered by a protectiveness because poor now has some rough spots in the book. And so I was wondering if there was any... You know, some authors have challenges harming their characters, but you don't let that get in your way. Was it something you struggled with?
No. I felt fairly, I kind of knew, you know, that now would be okay. It's not that she would be okay, but I trusted her, you know. I mean, and not only that, but I guess I don't really feel that I'm harming the characters when bad things happen to them. I don't really feel that level of agency. I don't know how to describe this exactly, but what's happening to the characters really is their doing, not mine. You know, and so in a way, it's not my role to be protective of them or to put them in harm's way either. My role is to just simply watch them carefully and record what's happening to them with as much accuracy as I can. I think that every writer has, you know, his or her own relationship to the emergence of a character on the page. But, you know, I've never felt that degree of authorship. You know, once again, perhaps this sounds a little disingenuous, but that's my feeling about it. You know, I'm sure that you know, maybe I'm just being irresponsible here. Maybe I'm just ducking the responsibility. But certainly that's my experience of it.
Okay. And for the third person point of view character Ruth, mm-hmm. I can ask about her because
yeah,
I was surprised to learn that you called it auditioning, which I thought was funny, given your history working in media. But the book struck me as female dominant. You have three strong female characters, but when you spoke about the character of Ruth and your auditioning of other characters for that role, you had considered some male characters and even more ambiguous characters. So I'm curious if the strong female, you know, aspect of the book was something that came later or never even occurred to you, or what role did that play?
Well, you know, to tell you the absolute truth about this process, you know, when I first heard Now's voice, when I first became aware that there was this character of Now out there in the world somewhere, wanting to sort of, you know, make herself known on the page, it did occur to me that, you know, her voice had come into my mind, and so therefore perhaps she was writing to me, you know, perhaps I was her reader. You know, I was her, you know, her interlocutor. And so it did occur to me at that point, and this was very early on in the process, that perhaps the character of the reader should be, you know, sort of played by, you know, by a character named Ruth, and that I should, you know, sort of put a version of myself into the book. And I rejected this pretty quickly. It seemed a little arbitrary. It seemed a little bit too postmodern and too metafictional, and without there being good reason for it. And so I rejected it, and that's when I started to audition, you know, to continue with this metaphor, audition other characters for the role. And it's very much as you say, you know, I would sort of invite a character in and arrange for the character to, you know, to find whatever version of the diary existed at the time, and the character would start to read it, and the fictional world would start to grow, and, you know, the characters would start to have a relationship. But then, you know, and I'd continue to be writing this, you know, and then about, I don't know, 50-100 pages in or so, I'd confront the manuscript one day and find that the fictional world had kind of collapsed, you know, it had deflated. And so I would show the character to the door and invite the next one in, and we would go through this whole process again. And this happened 4 or 5 times, you know, until I finally did finish, a manuscript in the beginning of 2011. And, it was very, very different from the book that's been published now. It had a very different reader in place. It was a kind of an ambiguous character who, believe it or not, had no specified gender and no name, and it was a very odd kind of surreal character. And I was about to submit it to my editor when the 2011 earthquake and tsunami hit the coast of Japan. And, you know, and that was a devastating event for many reasons. I mean, I have family and friends in Japan, in Tokyo, as well as in Sendai, which is in northern Japan, where the epicenter was. And so this was a really devastating event. But, you know, sort of as the weeks and months progressed, it began to occur to me that the book that I'd written was really no longer relevant in this new world. You know, that the earthquake and tsunami had sort of drawn a line in time and demarcated anything that, you know, sort of led up to that event as sort of pre-earthquake, pre-tsunami, pre-Fukushima. You know, and that was the world in which I'd written the book, and now we were living in a, you know, post-earthquake, post-tsunami, post-Fukushima world, and the book was no longer relevant. And it was very interesting because it was almost as though, you know, reality had intruded into this fictional world, you know, and there was no way to escape that. And so I, you know, withdrew the manuscript and was, you know, pretty much thinking about giving up on the project entirely. When my husband actually suggested, you know, he was the one who sort of made the suggestion that I revisit this idea of putting myself in the book, because now there seemed to be a reason to do it. Reality had already sort of destroyed the fictional world. And so if that was the case, then why not address that directly? And so it seemed to me to be a very, a good response to this. It would allow me to respond to the events that were happening in Japan, which I very much wanted to do because I was, I was very concerned with, the state of affairs in Japan, especially after the meltdown at Fukushima. And so I decided to go ahead and do that, you know, and to sort of step into the book as a character myself. But at the same time, you know, to go back to your original question, it seemed important to create a distance between, you know, Ruth the writer and Ruth the character, because they are different people. And so thus the decision to write that character in the third person seemed very clear to me right from the beginning.
That's interesting. It's fascinating to me that you spent 5 years with this manuscript and you had a complete version before the Fukushima nuclear disaster.
Yes. It was fascinating and very frustrating too. And this is not necessarily a recommendation for, you know, for how to write a novel. I think there are many more efficient ways of writing novels, and so I wouldn't necessarily recommend this to any novelists, in your listenership. This is the way that I had to write this particular novel. Hopefully it will be easier next time.
Can you talk just a bit about some of the rethinking you had to do? Like, originally, was the diary transmitted via the ocean, or was that...
No. The diary was transmitted in different ways each time. You know, each reader had his or her own way of discovering the diary. So there were various different ways. The ocean didn't come into it until after the earthquake and after the tsunami, because, you know, of course, at that point we were aware that there was this debris field that was slowly making its way across the across the Pacific, riding on the oceanic gyres. And so it was really only after the earthquake and tsunami that could be possible. So, before that, there were many other elements that kind of came into play. And I suppose, too, this was an interesting aspect of the process. Every time, I would go down the wrong fork, writing is very much like, sort of playing Dragons and Dungeons, or, playing a video game. You're on a quest, and you're trying to get from, the beginning of the story to the end of the story, and so you walk along the path, and the road forks, and, you kind of arbitrarily take, say, the right fork, and you continue down, and along the way, you might pick up certain things like a broadsword or a key or a map, until you finally reach a dead end, and then you realize you have to turn around and take the fork, the other fork, and so you do that. And so now you're progressing along the left fork, and suddenly you come across, say, a door, mm-hmm. and you think, oh, I have the key. And you take the key out of your pocket and, try it in the door, and, lo and behold, it unlocks the door. Now, you would never have that key if you hadn't taken the wrong fork earlier on. And so that was kind of the experience of writing the book. Every failed attempt sort of generated something that enriched the the journey along the way. So it was interesting. As I said, it was frustrating too, but sure. it was interesting.
Now, that experience with forks that you talked about, was that one that was paralleled in your experience in documentary filmmaking?
Well, documentary filmmaking has a whole other set of problems. And in honestly, in documentary filmmaking, yes, to some extent, it's that same, forking paths kind of experience. But in film, it costs too much to make too many mistakes, and so you have to really try very hard not to make costly, missteps along the way. So things tend to be a lot more planned and a lot less random. At least that's my experience. I was always running out of money making films, and found that to be an incredibly frustrating part of the experience. So I think that's probably one of the reasons why I started writing novels. You have a lot more freedom to screw up when you're writing.
I was curious about that evolution, because you had a significant career in commercial television and media production before coming to fiction writing. Can you talk a little bit more about that? What led you to fiction?
Yeah, well, I my whole life has been now that I think about it, it's been an exercise in forking paths and sort of trying one thing and then backing up and trying the next, but it's, I had been fully planning to go into an academic career in comp lit, and had been studying classical Japanese literature in Japan in order to do this. And then I came back to New York for various reasons and needed a job and needed a job quickly. And there wasn't a lot of sort of quick part-time jobs to be picked up in classical Japanese. And so I ended up, simply because, friends of mine were working in the New York film business at the time, I ended up getting a job being an art director on a horror film. And it was a very, very low-budget horror film because, of course, I'd never had any experience in on a film set or in any capacity with film at all at that time. I could draw a little bit. That was my qualification. And actually what happened was that they needed a storyboard artist, and so I was hired as a storyboard artist, and they never got around to doing a single storyboard, but suddenly realized a week before production was to start that, oh my God, we need an art director. We need a production designer. And so they looked around the room, and saw me sitting there and pointed at me and said, you be the production designer. I didn't know what a production designer did at the time, but that didn't seem to worry them. So they just said, we'll tell you what to do, just do it. And so that was how I started working in film. And the name of the film was Matt Riker, Mutant Hunt. And so I, made that film with them and then made a bunch of others. I think the second one was Breeders, Necropolis, Enemy Territory, Robot Holocaust. We did a whole series of films like that. And, it was fun. It was a lot of fun, and I learned an enormous amount, and, about how to build, orgasmatrons and breakaway walls and, robotic arms and stuff like that. It was a lot of fun. And then from there, segued into Japanese television. And so that's when I started really doing, I could speak Japanese, so I was useful on set, for Japanese productions. And so I started doing, production work for Japanese television. And eventually, it was interesting to me. I enjoyed doing documentary work, and I enjoyed being on set, but I knew somehow that that the place I really wanted to be was not in the director role so much, but I wanted to learn to edit, and so little by little I sort of talked my way into the editing room, and finally they allowed me to direct and edit shows, and that's really where I learned to create narrative. I didn't know how to to build narrative before that, and I remember. After college, I'm sorry, this is getting a little long-winded, but I remember after college trying to write novels, because I'd always wanted to write, but I remember being defeated by time, and I didn't really know how to create a story arc that that functioned in an efficient way. And so it wasn't until I got into the editing room and learned how to edit video that I learned to do that. And, television is very demanding. It really demands a tight story arc, one that doesn't just kind of leave you hanging. And so, doing that for several years was the best training I think I could have gotten in, in the construction of story. So that when I went back to writing, and when I, started writing my first novel, suddenly it was easy. This thing that had defeated me before was suddenly very clear and easy to do.
Yeah, you sure showed time. that was interesting. And I noticed on the trailer, I suspect that is that you acting in the book trailer online and also reading?
Yes. I mean, I don't know whether I'd call it acting, but yes, it's me walking around. Yeah, it was fun. I mean, it was nice because, who knew that authors, that novelists were going to have to make book trailers, right? But, with my background in film, it was like, I suddenly, I realized, like, great, I have the skills to do this, It's nice having a skill set, sort of reemerge, usefully later on. So, no, that was great.
Yeah, and you read the passage so naturally earlier, and also I've heard that you read the audiobook for your book.
Yes, I do. It was, I for some reason publishers I think don't really like to let novelists read their own audiobooks, and I suspect that that's probably because many novelists don't really read very well, and I think the other reason though is because by the time the audiobook goes into production, by the time the recording is done, the manuscript has already been transmitted and it's already in, it's in the process of being printed, and it's too late to make any changes. And so I think the worst nightmare is that the author will be reading the audiobook and come across a section that absolutely must, be changed, so, stop the presses, I must change this, this comma, and so it's probably, it's a publisher's worst nightmare, but what I realized is that if you put a lot of footnotes and especially use a lot of Japanese in your book, then, the publisher is a lot more inclined to let you do the reading. So that's what happened, and I did the audiobook recording, and I've never had as much fun doing anything you know, related to publishing as I had doing the recording of that book. It was just a lot of fun, and it reminded me a lot of you know, working with it, you know, working in film, because it was a team effort. You know, there was a director sitting there, a wonderful director who, you know, who was directing me as I was doing the recording. It was just an environment that I felt very, very comfortable in, and I just had the best time doing it.
Wow, that's and so you speak French as well as Japanese.
I speak enough French to get by and do the bits in the book that were required. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Great. Well, Ruth, we're unfortunately drawing down on our time, but before we let you go, do you have any words of writing advice for our writer listeners?
Well, you know, the one thing that I think I've learned, you know, doing all of these different things, but particularly writing, is that you really need patience, you know, and you know, however you can cultivate patience, that seems to me to be the probably the most important quality, because anytime you become impatient, you probably, you know, are damaging your work somehow. And so, you know, whatever it takes to cultivate patience, that seems to me to be, you know, the virtue, the cardinal virtue that writers need. So that would be my advice.
Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you, Nicole.
Yeah. And thank you so much for taking the time with us today.
Oh, sure. It's my pleasure. That was fun.
That was Ruth Ozeki, author of A Tale for the Time Being, published by Penguin, out now in paperback. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with us. Marie Stone will talk with Gina Frangello when we return. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.